The Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt blasts General Electric Corporation for trying to change the law so polluters won't have to pay for damages to natural resources. Some groundwater in Nevada is found to be radioactive. Will this scuttle the effort to store nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain? Animals have been falling into a 500-foot hole in Madagascar for thousands of years. We find out who is at the bottom. End of the Earth calendar, it's apple harvest time in the Northeast, and the cider is flowing out of the presses. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. A big fight is being waged in Washington over the law commonly known as Superfund, which deals with toxic waste. Superfund was originally enacted after the discovery of chemicals buried in the old Love Canal in a residential neighborhood in Niagara Falls, New York. Superfund is up for reauthorization, and many believe it needs revision because the process it established for the identification and cleanup of contaminated toxic waste sites is lengthy, cumbersome, and invites litigation. There are also provisions that allow for resource damages, and these are not well understood. Recently, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt visited New York's Hudson River, which is contaminated with PCBs, a chemical dumped by the General Electric Corporation, known as GE, from its factories along the waterway. He spoke on a windy hilltop overlooking the Hudson River Valley, which had been the home of Frederick Church, one of the most famous painters of the Hudson River School of Art. Babbitt is alarmed by efforts which GE and other corporations are making to change the resource damage provisions of Superfund.
As we meet here today, the General Electric Corporation is leading a lobbying effort in the United States Congress to weaken and gut the very laws that mandate the restoration of this river.
Babbitt says the restoration provisions of Superfund have received little notice.
It's not widely understood, is the restoration provisions of this law. We tend to think of the Superfund law as, plugging up the tailpipes that are pouring the stuff in the river. But there's another piece to the Superfund law which says, once you've stopped up the tailpipes and gotten rid of the emissions which are causing the problem, we have an obligation then to go out and restore the landscape and take care of the damage that's been done. It's a simple concept. Polluter pays.
So far, there have not been a large number of cases seeking resource damages from Superfund polluters. Typically, such cases would only start after cleanup of the dump site is completed, and the amount of a judgment could be very large.
The polluter would step up to the plate and pay money or undertake restoration on its own to restore the damage that has occurred, and also that they would compensate the public for the losses that have occurred pending the restoration. For example, for the closed fisheries, for the damage to wildlife.
That was Sarah Chases, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, a national environmental group that is fighting to keep existing resource damage provisions of Superfund in place. She says there are some big cases pending in Montana, Idaho, and California. Corporate defendants include ARCO and ASARCO. GE could be liable for huge sums for resource damages to the Hudson and Housatonic Rivers, where PCBs were dumped. Thus, corporate polluters have strong motivation to limit potential liability by changing resource damage provisions of Superfund. Mark Behan, a spokesman for the General Electric Corporation, confirms that GE is indeed lobbying for changes in resource damage provisions. What GE seeks is a far more limited approach. It wants to focus on remediation instead of reimbursing the public for the value of resources which may have been lost.
GE supports site-specific, risk-based remedies that are based on the real use of a piece of property, not some hypothetical use, and based on real cleanup standards that allow remedies that are tailored to the conditions of a piece of property as we find it and tailored to the needs of a specific community. And these remedies aren't always the most expensive remedies. Sometimes they're the most innovative remedies. And those remedies should stand on an equal footing with all kinds of treatment remedies and the most expensive remedies that the law is now pushing for.
The significance of the distinction which GE draws about remedies and resource damages based on real use of property worries wildlife advocates. They say under GE's definition, if an eagle population was destroyed by a release of toxic chemicals, it would only have to be restored if birdwatchers observed it. An eagle soaring in the sky unseen by humans is not being used by anybody. Thus, the polluter would not have to pay for its loss or replacement if GE's real use definition is adopted. At least one influential member of the U.S. Senate is opposed to the corporate position. He is Max Baucus, Democrat from Montana, who is ranking Democrat on the Committee on Environment and Public Works.
We have an obligation, I think, to restore for future generations. If somebody despoiled a site today for some economic use, I understand that, but if it's destroyed today and it's not cleaned up, if it's not restored to some basic natural intrinsic value, then it's lost for future generations. And I think it's really a moral question. Of course, it's wrong. It's immoral.
In the Environment Show's continuing series on resource damages, we'll be going to places where damages have occurred and speak to the folks who are trying to restore the losses. From 1968 to 1992, the federal government conducted underground tests of nuclear weapons in the Nevada desert. It was believed the dry climate would prevent radioactive materials from traveling in the groundwater. But recent tests show that radioactive material has traveled farther than was originally projected. The test comes as a federal agency considers placing a nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain near the bomb test site. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
Since 1973, federal scientists have been testing groundwater samples for radioactive material. The researchers are determining how groundwater may have been affected by the approximately 300 atomic bombs that were tested at the groundwater level, located 600 to 2,000 feet underground. Researchers are not only looking at levels of radioactivity, but the distance such materials may have traveled in the groundwater. Just recently, a test showed the presence of plutonium at a distance beyond estimations made by scientists, according to Los Alamos National Laboratory researcher Joseph Thompson.
We have not, in general, observed plutonium in groundwater at the Nevada test site. And so this one observation of a small amount of plutonium well outside of the point where it originated was indeed surprising. And we are, of course, very anxious to continue studying this. You should know, though, that the fact that the plutonium was found 1,300 meters away from the source does not mean that it got there necessarily entirely by travel with groundwater.
Thompson says radioactive materials can pass through sediment by a process known as fracturing. This occurs when cracks form following an underground atomic blast. Thompson says the amount of radioactivity detected in the groundwater is less than would be allowable in drinking water. The closest residents live 20 miles from the test site, and Thompson says they have no reason to be concerned. Meanwhile, state officials in Nevada say they are keeping a close eye on groundwater tests. Paul Liebendorfer is chief of the Bureau of Federal Facilities for the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection. He says Nevada has taken a more active role in the monitoring process.
To ensure that we understand the extent of what the groundwater contamination is, we need to decide whether or not any active form of containment or control is possible. We basically recognize that to clean up something that's at a 4,000-foot depth is not necessarily a rational alternative, but we do need to understand where the bounds of the contamination is and determine whether or not it can be. It will adequately control itself because of limited movement over a period of time, or whether some active containment and control was necessary.
Liebendorfer says while the slightly radioactive groundwater poses no immediate threat to nearby residents, there may come a time when it will be necessary to draw on the water resources. The presence of plutonium could not have come at a worse time for the Department of Energy. The federal agency has for years been considering creating a nuclear waste repository on Yucca Mountain, located approximately 25 miles from bomb test sites. The groundwater test results support what opponents to the repository, such as Nevada's U.S. Senator Richard Bryan, have claimed for some time, that Nevada is geologically not a good location for a nuclear waste site.
There are a number of fault lines, about 32 such fault lines, that run through the Yucca Mountain proposed site. Some of those are active earthquake fault lines. Indeed, we've had a number of earthquakes in the vicinity. That part of Nevada would be the second most active earthquake zone in the lower 48 states.
Even if the Department of Energy did approve Yucca Mountain as a repository site, Senator Bryan does not believe nuclear power companies would be successful in getting it licensed. He says since little progress has been made in creating a repository at Yucca Mountain, the utilities are pushing for an interim site located at the Nevada bomb test site, something Congress is currently considering.
What we're talking about there is a dry cast storage that would be placed at the Nevada test site. But that seems to make no sense at all because you'd be moving 77,000 metric tons of high-level nuclear waste over a period of decades across the major rail and highway corridors in the country, passing through 43 different states, 51 million Americans living within a mile or less of the site, the potential of an accident or a terrorist event. You can easily store that high-level nuclear waste on site.
The proposal to create a temporary storage site was passed by the Senate, but not with a margin large enough to override a presidential veto. The proposal has also passed the House of Representatives Committee, and members of the House are expected to vote on the proposal by the end of the year. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show.
I'm Peter Burley, and we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can reach us by email. The address is green@wamc.org. You can also reach us anytime over the Internet where you can hear The Environment Show. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. The island of Madagascar, located off the eastern African coast, has long been known as a treasure trove for lemur populations. Lemurs are mainly nocturnal primates that were once found in many parts of the eastern world, but are now largely confined to Madagascar. Since foreigners arrived at the island, some 16 lemur species have become extinct. In recent years, paleontologists and other scientists have discovered a large sinkhole, which is providing a literal mountain of information on the unique primates. Information that may change the way we view their evolution. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips reports.
While natives of the island knew of the sinkhole's existence for years, it wasn't until 1994 that scientists in the United States actually began conducting research at the large pit. The pit was named Ankilitelo, meaning three trees that guard the site. Lori Godfrey, professor of anthropology at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, is among the American scientists conducting research at the sinkhole. She says just traveling to the pit is difficult, given the rough terrain of Madagascar. Ankilitelo is located in the remote southwestern part of Madagascar.
It's a remarkable place because it's over 500 feet deep. It's about 10 meters in diameter at the top. But the pit, it's an enormous sinkhole in a karst topography or an eroded limestone bed topography. And at the bottom of it, of course, lie the bones of animals that have fallen in, usually accidentally fallen into the pit. And at the bottom of the 500 feet deep pit is a mini mountain about 100 feet tall in itself, which contains rocks and sediments and the bones of the animals who unfortunately fell in.
Professor Godfrey says the enormous depth of the pit, equivalent to scaling a 50-story building, forced scientists to hire professional climbers to rappel to the bottom. For the past several years, climbers have been providing Godfrey and other researchers with an array of fossils.
There are, in fact, at the bottom of the pit, bones of several giant extinct lemurs of Madagascar, bones of the living lemurs that are there now in the region now, and also that may have been there in the past, but not now. And in addition to that, there are bones of, there's eggshell of elephant birds, which are these enormous, now extinct, half-ton birds, flightless birds from Madagascar. There are giant tortoise shells. There are bones of carnivores in the cave, in the sinkhole.
Radiometric dating has shown that some of the extinct lemur fossils are only 500 years old. Godfrey says the fact that some of the species are recently extinct gives herself and other scientists the unique opportunity to understand how the animals evolved.
We can use this material to reconstruct the changes in the geographic ranges of these animals, including the animals that are still living in Madagascar. They may be living in Madagascar, but living in very small, restricted regions of Madagascar. But yet we know that 4,000 years ago or 1,000 years ago, these animals lived in X, Y, or Z places because of the work that we're doing there. And then we can reconstruct the anatomy of these animals. We can reconstruct aspects of their life cycles, the development of these animals, their ontogeny, so to speak. And from the lemur bones themselves, we can help, we can try to reconstruct the changes in the environment.
Professor Godfrey says studying the inhabitants of the island also allows scientists to make projections into the future. In addition, Godfrey says the island provides scientists with a large-scale model of the evolutionary process. She says most of the primates arrived at the island through a process known as rafting. After Madagascar separated from the African continent 165 million years ago.
But what happened in Madagascar is that because these animals arrived at an early point in time, and because of Madagascar's isolation from the rest of the world, these animals radiated, and Madagascar, on Madagascar, there evolved this amazing fauna of primates, of certain groups of animals that are unique to the rest of the world. And so, in effect, Madagascar has been a kind of an experiment in evolution.
Currently, 32 types of lemurs remain on the island. Professor Godfrey says while efforts are underway to protect the animals, more needs to be done. Besides the scientific benefits Ankilitelo is providing, Godfrey hopes her research will bring about an increased awareness into the plight of the primates and the way humans have impacted this isolated ecosystem. For the Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar, and once again, we look at the Great American Harvest. It's autumn in the Northeast, a time for sweaters, pumpkins, corn, and of course, apples. Whether your favorite is a Delicious or a Macintosh, or one of those new hybrids, it's that time of year when apples are being picked. Peter Tanike is owner of Indian Ladder Farms in upstate New York, and he says this year's crop got off to a rough start.
Well, for the state, it's a about an average year, within 5%. For us, it's a small crop. We had some really hard pollinating weather where the bees couldn't find the conditions for bee flight and doing the pollinating in the spring. So we had a poor fruit set. People don't understand that if you take the seeds out of a Macintosh apple and plant them, you don't get a Macintosh apple tree. You get a cross between whatever the Macintosh seed and whatever pollen came from some other variety. So it's a cross that's the seed, and the apple itself is actually the womb or the uterus of the mother.
The Tanaik family has been in the apple-producing business for four generations. While Peter knows the business inside and out, there's only so much control he has over the quality of his crop. He says there are a number of factors that affect it.
Well, for quantity issues, pollination is probably the biggest one. And then whether the blossoms that were on the trees this spring were made last spring. So if there were good growing conditions during the first 3 weeks in June last year, the tree put down a lot of apple buds, so potentially there could be a large crop by the size of the bloom. Then pollination is the next hurdle, that if you cross that hurdle, then you pretty much set your crop. By the end of the month of June, an apple has all the cells that it'll ever have, and so the only thing can happen from that point on is increases in size. And then the other two hurdles are quality hurdles, and those are things like hail and the amount of rain that affect, and hopefully we can control diseases and insect problems.
Harvesting apples is hard work. Battling the ladder, branches, rain, and bugs is not easy. Nonetheless, Tanaik says each picker brings down about 110 to 120 bushels of apples a day. He says an average of a dozen pickers help to harvest a year's crop.
This year, we only have 9 people picking. And so you just try to match the number of workers. And we're very lucky because the fellows that we have picking for us are turn out to be from Jamaica. It's very hard to find people who are willing to commit themselves to work a full harvest, rain or shine, up and down the ladder. And so we apply to get workers, and we end up with this crew that has been with us a lot of years, and they're very professional. I would probably take me close to 3 times as many unskilled people to do the work that that these fellows are able to do.
Once the apples have been picked, they're sorted to determine which will be sold at retail, which will be made into applesauce, or the favorite of many apple lovers, which will be made into cider. He says many of the apples he produces will end up in the cider mill because he won't put wax on his apples.
As customers get fussier and fussier about their apples, and they're encouraged by the chain stores, for instance, chain stores basically only sell waxed apples, and I just refuse to wax apples. I can't see any sense of it. And so therefore a larger percentage of the crop falls below the grade that we want to have, and therefore they are an opportunity to be turned into a more value-added added product like cider. We get maybe 3.5 gallons of cider out of a bushel of apples, and so that's about the average yield, and so we try to set aside enough to be able to handle our retail trade.
In the end, Tanaik says half his apple crop will be sold at retail, the other half at the wholesale level. He says he enjoys the business, but admits it's not always easy, especially at this time of year.
It's pretty stressful, but it's satisfying in the sense of being completely coupled up with a process. I mean, a hands-on watching them grow and watching them pick them and to try to market them, to be in that close approximation to an actual real-time process rather than a desk and chair thing is pretty satisfying. And I find that, you know, with all my years of experience and with maybe $100,000 worth of machinery and equipment and all the research facilities of Cornell University, I can move the Lord's work about 1% in either direction.
Tanaik says consumers are often fooled into believing that if an apple is green, it's not ripe. Redness of an apple only shows the amount of sunlight it receives, so the green side of an apple will be just as sweet as the red side so long as the apple is ripe. So for those apples that don't receive enough sunlight and are subsequently left on the store shelf, it proves one thing. As Kermit the Frog says, it's not easy being green. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Bye.
This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlin. Still ahead, we meet the folk who are watching ice streams flow in Antarctica. They're trying to find out if the climate controls the flow or the flow determines the climate. We talk green with leading experts about children and cancer and what you can do to reduce the risk for your kids. And author Peter Jenkins presents a portrait of a special place in the Gulf of Mexico on a dark night. These stories coming up. The Antarctic, where the South Pole is located, is a huge continent covered with ice. It's an unlikely place to find humans, but considerable scientific research is being carried out there. The Environment Show's Rachel Phillips reports.
In November and December, you'll find a team of approximately 9 researchers from Caltech on the Antarctic ice sheet. The scientists are part of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, or WAIS, program, which is part of the Office of Polar Programs of the National Science Foundation. Barclay Kam, professor of geology and geophysics at Caltech, leads the researchers on their 3-month excursion as they study ice streams located beneath the massive continent. The scientists are trying to understand how the ice streams work.
They are like ocean currents in the ocean, like the Gulf Stream or something, but this is in the ice sheet that covers the Antarctic continent, except for 2% of it that's not covered. There are places where over a width of 50 kilometers or so, the ice is moving a meter or so a day, whereas the ice outside of that current or ice stream is moving only a few meters a year. It's a tremendous contrast in the flow rate, in the motion of the ice. And this is what we're interested in. We're interested in the mechanics of it and the cause of it.
Professor Kam says the scientists have been focusing their attention on one particular stream named Ice Stream B, located beneath the West Antarctic ice sheet. Kam says researchers use a special drill and equipment to gather data on the slow-moving stream.
We drill to the bottom of the ice sheet, or at the bottom of the ice stream, and we put down instruments which will measure different quantities, different characteristic variables at the base of the ice. And for example, the obvious one is temperature. That's the most significant one because it turns out that if the ice is below freezing at the base of the ice mass, so the ice is frozen to the substrate, then there's no rapid motion. But rapid motion can occur when the base of the ice reaches the melting point.
Kam says understanding the mechanics of rapid motion is at the heart of his research. He says scientists believe the ice sheets move as a result of a layer of sediment acting like a lubricant, allowing the stream to move faster than normal.
We have shown that there is such a layer, and we have sampled it and studied its properties. And we've also shown that the base of the ice is at the melting point, which is necessary, as I said before, for this kind of action to occur. And we've shown that the pressure of water in the pores and conduit system that must be present down there at the bottom of the ice, the pressure of water is very high enough, nearly high enough to float the ice mass. And this is exactly the conditions suitable for very rapid motion. But still, the key question is this rapid motion due to the lubrication of this sediment layer that I mentioned, or is it due to a more conventional mechanism, which is ice sliding over bedrock?
Measurements show both forces are allowing the streams to move. Kam says researchers now have to determine whether their conclusion is valid for other streams as well. The streams are important because they give insight into the stability of the Antarctic ice sheet. If the ice sheet was converted into a faster streaming flow, sea levels could rise significantly. Such issues involving Kam's team's research may be applied to studies of global warming. He says scientists are trying to determine whether streams are controlled externally by climate or whether they are internally controlled and not dependent on worldwide or local climate.
The way in which global climate could control the motion of the ice sheet and its possible disintegration is through the thickness of the ice shelves that surround the ice sheet. Now, that's like the Ross Ice Shelf. Perhaps you've heard of that. It's an area of floating ice, the order of 1,000 meters thick, the size of the state of Texas, roughly, which is fed by flow from these ice streams. The ice streams flow down off the continent and finally go afloat and merge together to form this huge, huge ice shelf, the Ross Ice Shelf. And the idea is that the thickness of that ice shelf is the controlling factor on the motion of the ice sheet adjacent to it, and that climatic change can affect the ice shelf by affecting the temperature and salinity of water or seawater from around the Antarctic continent that circulates in a convective circulation under the ice shelf.
There is a possible interaction between the worldwide climate and ice through the effects of ocean temperature and salinity on the ice shelf. But CAM says such issues will be left to other geophysicists and scientists. CAM's research is unique. No other programs are looking solely at the mechanics of the ice streams beneath the Antarctic surface. He expects his research to continue for about another 4 years. Meanwhile, ongoing research from the Western Antarctic Ice Sheet Program can be found in the Antarctic Journal and other scientific journals. For The Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about children and cancer and the environment. Statistics show that there has been an increase in children's cancer, and recently the first ever federal conference was held on environmental links to childhood cancer. Three experts who participated in that conference are with me. They're Dr. Robert Amler, who is Chief Medical Officer of the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, which is a federal public health agency. Dr. Henry Falk, and he is the Director of Division of Environmental Hazards and Health Effects at the National Center for Environmental Health, which is part of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And Dr. Steve Galson, who is Scientific Director of the Office of Children's Health Protection at the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. He joins us from Washington. So let me start with you, Dr. Amler. Is there indeed an increase in children's cancer?
There is indeed, Peter, and it's really a paradox because there's been a tremendous benefit over the last two decades in survival rates for children who have cancer. Children are surviving with various tumors that were virtually incurable two decades ago. And yet the sad fact is while these treatment rates are better and better and survival rates are better, the incidence rate, that is the occurrence of new cancers in children, is on the increase, ranging from 1% per year to 2 to 4% per year for certain tumors and cancers.
Dr. Falk, from the CDC, what is the possible environmental link to this?
Well, given the increase that has been fairly steady now for approximately two decades or even longer, one has to be concerned that possibly changes in the environment may be related to these changing incidence rates. And I think one of the more interesting parts of the conference was discussion of studies that have been done in recent years suggesting that environmental factors may possibly be related to this increase.
And I realize it's tough to generalize, but is it fair to say there is an environmental link here or not?
Well, I think because the rates are increasing, we think that there may well be an environmental link, but and there have been a number of suggestions that different types of chemicals, possibly pesticides, possibly parental occupation, other kinds of factors may be involved. But I think we're still at the stage where many of these suggested causes really need more definitive analysis.
Well, Dr. Galson, let's go to you. Carol Browner has made an important part of her administration the notion that we would do our best as a nation to protect our children. What does your office of the Office of Children's Health Protection, where do you fit into this? What are you folks doing about it? How do you react to the kind of statistics that Dr. Amler has told us about?
What we're trying to do is act as a focal point for Environmental Protection Agency activities related to children's adverse health effects from the environment. So we're looking across the board at all of the Environmental Protection Agency's activities to determine whether what we're doing in each area is protective enough of children. In particular, we're looking at some of the regulations that are in the process of being promulgated by the agency to determine whether they've adequately considered the effects of children who are more sensitive to many environmental toxins in the way that they're setting up the protective levels.
And so, indeed, do we need to make changes at this point to give our kids a better break?
We think so, and we're already making them. A great example is the new clean air regulations that Administrator Browner and the President have really spent a lot of time over the last few months advocating. And the change in the ozone standard in particular is based on concerns about health effects in children.
Well, this all sounds very theoretical, but I guess the real question is how much concern to the parents of America is justified, and what do you want to say to them and really any one of you about where we're going in terms of coping with what statistically appears to be a not insignificant increase in children's cancer?
Well, it's very important for parents to be aware of the potential for children being exposed to toxic substances in their environment. Children crawl around on the floor. They tend to ingest more dirt than adults do just from how they play. And they may be exposed to chemicals and other exposures that adults are just not aware of.
I would add to that, too, by saying that children who are no longer crawling but are running around and playing in the neighborhoods often get into places and locations that they should not be. Most of our hazardous waste sites in the U.S., and there are over 1,000 on the national priorities list, are fenced and supposed to restrict access. But in fact, many fences can be breached, and if anyone can figure out how to breach them, it's a playful child. In addition, their parents often may work in plants or other locations where they can bring toxic substances home on their clothing. And we have several examples of children who got toxic levels of substances simply because the clothing was not changed or cleaned properly before bringing it home.
One of the things that comes to mind as you speak, as you mentioned toxic levels, is that I know for years people wondered about whether when we're setting levels, and normally those were levels that were dangerous for healthy adults, whether we needed to reduce those levels to deal with a higher vulnerability of children. Are we now at a point where the higher vulnerability of children is built into the standard setting and the level setting when we talk about appropriate exposures?
Well, we're moving in that direction. I don't think we're there yet. As I mentioned, the air pollution regulations were changed because of concerns about children, predominantly for the ozone. The advice from the CDC about lead exposure is clearly based on concerns about the effects on that age group. So we're moving there, but we have a long way to go.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We're talking about children's health and environmental links to cancer with Dr. Amler from the Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, Dr. Falk from the Center for Disease Control, and Dr. Galson from the Environmental Protection Agency. I see we have a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mary, you're Talking Green in the Environment Show.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. I have a question for all three panelists related to nutrition. I'm not sure if this is something you deal with a lot, but it sounds like it should be linked. I'm the mother of a three-year-old, and she's just switched daycares and is now receiving snacks that are mostly cookies and crackers, high-salt crackers, pretzels. And my husband and I have been watching the news, and we just saw a Journal of Pediatrics report that said 1% of kids are getting what they need in terms of whole grain vegetables and fruits, whole grains, fruits and vegetables. And I'm wondering if this is something I should be pushing at daycare, if it's related to the work that you're doing.
Okay, well, let's hear from all of you, nutrition and cancer and the environment and what's good for kids.
Well, this is Dr. Galson. Obviously, nutrition is very important, not just for cancer prevention, but for general good health. I don't think there's enough scientific information right now to give you specific examples about what daycare snacks can help your child reduce their risks of cancer. But I think we can all certainly say that good nutrition is better than poor nutrition, and that if you can advocate daycare providing healthy snacks and fruits and vegetables according to national guidelines, which recommend, you know, 5 servings a day for children and adults of fresh fruit and vegetables, then that would certainly be better.
I have another question about sunscreen, that we put layers and layers of sunscreen all summer long on our kids in daycare.
What's your question?
Are there things in sunscreen that we should be worried about?
The sunscreen has been really demonstrated to be very important in terms of reducing the chance of children getting sunburned, and we know that probably the biggest component of risk for adults developing skin cancer is from the sun exposure they had when they were children. I'm not aware of any reports or data linking elements of sunscreen as a hazard.
Okay, well, I want to thank our caller, and yes.
Peter, this is Henry Falk.
Yes.
If I may follow up for a moment, one of the important points that was brought out at the conference is that the process that leads to cancer in children is likely to be very complex and perhaps a result from some interaction of multiple factors like factors in the environment interacting perhaps with susceptibility factors in an individual or conceivably with substances and contaminants that are found in foods. So I think until we actually understand how this full process plays itself out, it is important to pay attention to reducing potential risks wherever they may be, till we understand exactly how they all interact.
And that's the tough one, isn't it? Because since this process is so complicated that we may never understand all of it, what kind of advice do you give to young mothers like the caller that we just spoke to so that they, A, can do the best they can, but B, not live in such total fear of the unknown that they're paralyzed? What do you tell folk out there?
Well, one piece of advice, again, coming back to pesticides, is you may not be able to control every residue on every food that you eat, but you certainly have a lot of control over your own house. And you should be very careful about the use of sprays and other methods to control insects and other pests in your house. There is this process I mentioned called integrated pest management. You can get pamphlets on this from the EPA or CDC or ATSTR, and it's basically a method to control pests with the least toxic alternatives. So be careful about what you bring into your own home.
Let me ask you all another question that's bothered me, and that is, if indeed we're seeing this increase in childhood cancers, is that because they are actually increasing, or we're simply doing a better job at identifying them?
Well, this was discussed at the conference, and that's actually a very important question, and it's very clear that over the last 20 years, in many ways, we have much better diagnostic tools that are available to us. So it is realistic to ask that question and to assume that for certain kinds of tumors, better diagnosis has helped identify more children with specific illnesses, and so that may reflect a part of the increase. On the other hand, for some of the childhood cancers, very clearly we have been able to diagnose them for many years, and the general feeling at the conference was that the increases are real. So maybe a small portion might be related to better diagnostic methods, but that certainly doesn't explain the larger part of the increase.
So following up on that, go ahead.
I'm sorry, remember that these increases are occurring at a time when many other diagnoses like infectious disease are decreasing, even though we are also better able to diagnose those conditions.
So following up on that, what is or should be a national strategy to cope with the increases?
Well, that's why we held the meeting. We got the experts together from across the country, and we split up into working groups, and we got their ideas about what they thought the research, what leads should be followed in the research that's done over the next decade. We're putting that all together, but there are a couple things I could tell you that people agreed with just on the basis of what we know from sitting through those meetings last week. One is that we need better interdisciplinary and collaborative studies of suspected environmental causes and mechanisms of children's cancer. What does that mean? It means scientists that do studies of disease trends in populations need to get together with scientists who work in laboratories with test tubes and cells to collaborate on studies so that we can look at the interaction of specific chemicals and disease outcomes.
Well, I'm afraid our time is up, and I feel as though we've just gotten into what I think is a critical subject, and that relates to cancer and the environment and children. We're talking Green and the Environment Show. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we'd like to hear from you. My guests today have been Dr. Amler, who is with the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, Dr. Falk, who is with he is the director of the Division of Environmental Hazards and Health Effects at the National Center for Environmental Health, and Dr. Steve Galston, who is scientific director of the Office of Children's Health Protection at EPA. We've been talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Peter Jenkins, whose new book, Along the Edge of America, published by Houghton Mifflin, the place is on the water in the Gulf of Mexico, not far from the dry Tortugas Islands. He presents a portrait of a special night on the water.
The turbulence of the waves was calming rapidly, as was the wind, finally. We had to decide where we would anchor for the night. If the wicked wind picked up again, Scott said, we'd have to anchor behind one of the keys that made up the dry Tortugas. But he thought it was going to slack off and be calm, and if so, we could anchor anywhere. Whatever we did, we needed to do it soon. It was almost dark. We anchored for the night where the water drops off from 20 to 75 feet. What happened next was one of several deeply enchanting moments in a night impossible to forget. I felt a familiar tightening in my chest, a quickened heartbeat, as my traveler's instincts told me to focus all my attention on the next moments and hours, to feel the place, to stare at it, to be overwhelmed. As many hundreds and thousands of nights that Scott had spent on the sea, he too commented on how beautiful the evening was. Then we both grew quiet, staring toward where the sun had been inhaled by the purple-black gulf. Warm breezes puffed from the Caribbean current. The Cooper swayed gently on anchor, rocking us into relaxation as we gazed skyward. The sky was the blackest I'd ever seen. It was blacker than the ebony skies of mountainous Idaho, where I'd camped out while walking across America. This night sky was not cold and endless. It was soft, embracing, like warm, black velvet. Somehow it seemed rounded at the edges. Against this backdrop, the stars and the shooting stars, the planets and flying satellites shone with a diamond-pure glitter, every one of them thrilling. The sea was black calm, gleaming like hand-rubbed black marble with the slightest tracings of gold. The black sky and the black gulf seemed to blend together. Then a moon made of ivory and gold rose majestically out of the darkness. The days and nights on the big waters take much, hurt much, but they also give much, too. We've been beaten around and blown around getting here, but what a reward the night was. If heaven has night, it will be like this one. Too bad we don't have a light to hang over the side, Scott said after a while. A light would attract a lot of marine life to it. I've got a spotlight I can clip onto the boat's batteries and shine into the water, I said. Might work. I went to fetch the light. The spotlight turned the water a ghostly, aqua blue. I was staring into the circle of light when a log about as thick as a 20-year-old pine tree drifted by. That couldn't be a log. Scott came over. We waited for it to come back. Meanwhile, flying fish darted through the light. One glided across my view and one hit the boat. A little snake, a snake, slithered across the top of the water, and I scooped it up with my small bait net. But it wasn't a snake after all. Scott said it was an uncommon chain moray eel, only about 8 inches long, with a dotted white line down its back. I let it go. The ghost-colored log was back. Scott took a look and said it was a bruiser barracuda. He hadn't seen one that long and that thick in a long time. Usually barracuda get caught before they can grow this big. He said these reefs must be loaded with fish. This is one of those special times, he added before he went down to his bunk. But there was no way I could go down below and sleep. It had been years since my head, my body, and my spirit had been soaring so high. I felt practically weightless. So I stayed outside with the purple-black sky and the crystal stars.
Peter Jenkins' new book is entitled Along the Edge of America and is published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can't find your way out of the pit in Madagascar without a tape of this show. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 405. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, and producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Weska. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver and Janie Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Bob and Marilyn Schumann. Also, Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.